Here we are past the halfway point of 2016, and here I am, for the third time this year, talking about KISS. Yes, be warned, take cover, this is yet another KISS episode. I've said this over and over again, that the podcast Moonlights is a KISS podcast, but I always say it with a mixture of trepidation and embarrassment. I know that KISS isn't for everyone. They're a very popular band, one of the biggest of all time. They've gone gold, they've gone platinum, sold millions of records, but think about all the people who didn't buy KISS records. They're the majority, and those are the people I am more aware of when I talk about KISS on this platform, dragging listeners who may not like their music through another nauseating discussion on a band that means little to them. So be it. I find the only way I can persistently pull it off is if I wrangle someone else to partner up with, and also someone who many may not know to be a big KISS fan. It's almost like thumbing my nose at their KISS disdain. Earlier this year, I had Frank Novinick from Hatebreed on episode 119 and Abbath on episode number 126, both talking about their extreme fandom for the band. It wasn't surprising that both were fans, but rather it was the extent of their fandom that surprised me. Again, it happened after I had Inge Johansson on the podcast earlier this year on episode number 118. Inge was the bassist in the now-defunct INC, International Noise Conspiracy, and now plays in Against Me. Him and I talked about Glenn Danzig and Danzig's recent Skeletons covers album, and afterwards he emailed me and divulged that he was a big KISS fan as well, and that he'd love to come back sometime and talk about KISS with me. Well, that time is now. As luck would have it, we were in Umeå, Sweden, Inge's hometown, to play the U-Rock Festival at the Campus Arena this past May 26th, and he was in town. If Inge is home and there's a KISS talk to be had, there is no way I can plow through town without having him on the podcast. So that's what we did. This was the first festival of the summer season and our first show in 5 months. I was a little nervous to play, but talking about KISS and hanging with Inge here really took my mind off any unnecessary nerves. We talked KISS. I played rock. Overall, it was a great day. Now, many of these podcasts are recorded on the road, like this one. So are the intros. Currently, I'm 5 weeks into a 7-week summer festival tour. I don't have my usual blue mics to record this podcast's intro, so I'm doing this in a makeshift style. I hope you don't mind the possible low-tech sound of my voice, but I have to make do in order to stay on target, keep on schedule, and have you hear this wonderful discussion with Inge and I talking about KISS, the hottest band in the land. Thanks to Blue Mic Microphones and Skull Candy Headphones for supporting the podcast. This podcast supports Chino Loco's restaurants because sometimes I want a fish burrito stuffed with chow mein noodles. And this podcast supports, well, KISS and KISS products. Here we go. Inge Johansson is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's co-hotel for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes. Damn it, from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down. Down.
Danko Jones has a podcast. It's called the Danko Jones podcast.
Excited. girls, get ready, because the Danko Jones Podcast starts!
No!
Warmed up, I'm feeling like I'm happy to see you. I'm, laid back in this hotel room of yours that, you know, they put a very modern touch to this. This was built for the Umeå was the cultural capital of Europe in the year 2014.
No way.
Yeah. That's why the city center looks completely different from when you were here the first time. And even like 5 years ago, it didn't look like this. I moved from Umeå in 2011, and that's when they started sort of rebuilding everything in the city center. So this is a new place with a supposedly more of a cultural touch.
I think the first time we came here was in 02, and all you guys came out.
Totally.
All the Noise Conspiracy. All you guys were here. And I remember when we revisited here years later.
Yeah.
Maybe even like 6 years later. And I did feel it was different. But then when we came the first time, it was like, it was total darkness.
Yep.
And very cold. And I couldn't really make heads or tails of anything.
I remember that show. I just got back from a long, in many, many ways, a long US-Australian tour. One of those tours. And we were about to split up the band. And I went to see Danko Jones play at the, I think you played at the university that time.
Yeah, I was going to say it was something like a campus thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And same area as you're going to play tonight, actually.
Okay.
But I think you're outdoors.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember that show because it was one of those, like, I had been home for not even a week, sort of like now, and just, like, got up there, super jet-lagged, and just, like, wasn't feeling very good about all the, like, you know, what was going on in the band. And I think, I mean, it all, you know, resolved later on, but that was like, so, okay, something's cool is gonna happen, all right, okay, I'm gonna go to the show. And And I remember I got so happy because you played that, "Hey, Papa, I'm like you." And you looked at me and like, "Hey, Inge."
Did I say that? Yeah, I must have said it.
Yeah, you did that in one of the courses, and I started laughing so much. So that made me so happy. I still remember that to this very day. I was just like, oh, yeah, that was fun, you know?
That's how I remember this city,
Umeå.
I remember it because I'm like, oh, that's where Noise Conspiracy is from. That's how I remember this city.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's how because of that show.
That's pretty
you guys,
cool.
Yeah, you guys all showed up. I'm like, oh, wow, this show's going to be fucking great, man. Fucking Noise Conspiracy is here. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Came by, yeah.
But, I mean, now, you know, we did the podcast over Skype.
I
thought that was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun, man, and I got a lot of positive feedback from friends listening to it.
Including one London May. Did he contact you about it?
Yeah, we've been hanging out lately because I've been hanging out in Los Angeles lately. And he was stoked on it, and he thought, you know, oh, you guys were so cool, you know, you're so, oh my God. And it was like, yeah, of course. I mean, we're talking about you. It's going to be great.
Yeah. And so, you know, knowing that we'll be in Umeå and, you know, who knows where you are in the world right now, but you just happen to be nearby.
Yep.
So instead of doing a dancing podcast number two, you had the idea to, your suggestion was doing a Kiss podcast. Yeah. I didn't know that you were this big of a Kiss fan, to be honest with you.
I'm this is very problematic for me. People, because as I told you, I don't really listen to Kiss that much. But I spend at least like 1 hour every day thinking about Kiss in some kind of active way, you know. I follow all the social media. I'm in all the fan groups on Facebook. I buy every biography, every DVD. In 2013, they released all the like their catalog on vinyl again, reissued. I bought all of those.
Didn't listen to it, but bought it.
No, yeah, yeah. They look very good next to the other like 80 Kiss LPs that I own. Kiss was the band that got me into music. Like I was 7 years old in 1984, and I heard Heavens on Fire on the radio, and that's when I started liking music. That's when I realized that I like rock music. I like pop music. That it happened. That's when I had that big moment of like, when you have that, like I remember being so, still to this very day, I can remember how that music just filled me up with positive, strong, positive feelings. And it didn't help that I got to see the video on Swedish television later on, and they just looked cool and long hair and like guitars that looked like axes, and one guy was jumping in a ring of fire, and I didn't understand what all the girls were doing there in the, you know, that came later on. But man, yeah, that was like my introduction to music. Kiss was, to me, as important part of my childhood as Star Wars. If you were born in the like mid or late 70s, you know, a lot of, especially boys, I guess, have a special relationship to Star Wars. So it was like Kiss and Star Wars, and they were equally unreal. There was like no difference between Ace Frehley and Luke Skywalker. Right. It was like
the same. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. And I totally lived that band and that fantasy up until when I got into heavier stuff, you know, when I was around 11, 12. Then I got into Metallica and like harder bands like that. And then I sort of segued on into punk. But yeah, I did that sort of beginning with Kiss and Maiden and Priest and then on to Metallica and a flirt with Swedish death metal and all that. And so yeah, they were such an important part of my life and part of why I'm into music. And for a while I could even like consider like seeing my whole family die tragically in a car accident or something, if it meant that I could be adopted by either Gene Simmons, Paul Stanley, Peter Criss, or Ace Frehley.
That's pretty diehard.
Yeah, I mean.
But where's the dilemma that you speak of?
It's like, it's one of those things where I like to say that I'm not afraid of spiders. I just respect them. It's sort of the same thing when I say, "Yeah, I don't really like Kiss." I'm
you know. But I understand that. I understand it because you like the entity, the concept,
yeah,
more than the actual content, right?
Oh yeah, that's a very good way of putting it.
But I understand that because I really believe Kiss is bigger than their songs.
Definitely.
And it's the reason why, you know, I write for Close Up here in Sweden, Close Up magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
And my editor, Roban, sent me an email once and he said, "Stop writing about Kiss. It's enough. You've yeah. written about Kiss for a whole year nonstop. We're getting letters from readers, getting pissed off that you don't talk about anything else." And I understood it. I stopped. but I also, the reason why is because there's just, after 40 plus years of being a band, you're more than just your songs. You there's so many other things that have happened. And these guys don't stray away from the spotlight. They're not, you know, recluses. They go out and they take chances and a lot of failures along the way. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes them, I think, endearing to all of us and keeps us fans. And it keeps them interesting, you know. And when you have no failures or any stumbles, uh-huh. your credibility is pristine, but it's also kind of boring, you know. And the what makes Kiss so enjoyable to talk about is some of their missteps.
Definitely, or just the fact that you and I suffer from Kiss Tourette's, that we see things and we're just like, oh, and you make a Kiss association and you start talking about Kiss.
Absolutely.
That happens to me a lot. Well, yeah, they've been around for 40 years plus.
Yeah.
And 35 of those years are, it's just madness. It's a lot of missteps and there's a lot of... you know, trial and error, and a lot of building an image where there's no, like, real, like, an image of being bigger than they actually are, and all that, and still they manage to cling on, and I have, I sort of, as I said, like, I spend a lot of time thinking about Kiss and talking about Kiss, but I don't listen to them that much. That part of my life is, or at least I don't really follow, like, I mean, I bought Sonic Boom and I bought Monster, but it doesn't, even though they're really trying to sort of recreate something from the past, it doesn't really register with me. I rather listen to stuff that was, I mean, the Kiss that I discovered in real time was Gene, Paul, Bruce, and Eric. You know, the 80s lineup.
Right. Yeah.
Which is incredibly important to me. And that's the kind of stuff you kind of get nostalgic about today. Because the non-makeup era was so short, if you compare it to, like, all those years after they got back together and they've been wearing makeup. So that's almost the era now that you sort of get a bit nostalgic about.
And I do. 13 years out of 40 years was spent without makeup.
Yeah.
And exactly how you say is how I feel, is that's the era that I feel is the, slowly as time moves forward, that will become the special era of Kiss. That 13 years of, like, not wearing the makeup. And that is overlooked. Not to also to mention that within that era, they put out some real lemons. I mean, terrible records. But they also put out a couple of really, really good ones.
Oh, yeah, man. I totally agree. And it was basically the Paul Stanley Band during that time. You know, he kept it alive. Gene was busy doing all other things, and Bruce and Eric or Mark or Vinny, you know, they were just like, I mean, they were hired guns, basically. We didn't understand that when we were kids, but now we do, you know. And I think that looking back on it now, it's so funny that they talk about those years of being sort of, you know, those were the rough years, the hard years, they were out in the cold and all that, but they still sold like platinum, and they toured not stadiums but arenas, and they had singles and all that. So you know, that's Kiss's perspective on things.
I
when
know.
They're not on top,
know,
you know, that, oh my god, this is so rough, we got only 8,000 people here in Leipzig tonight. This sucks.
Yeah, it's funny when they talk about it,
yeah,
because they did score, like, arguably, like, their biggest hits. Really, I mean, of course, there's Rock and Roll All Night and Beth, but there's, like, Heaven's on Fire.
It's,
like,
ultimately
huge. Lick It Up was huge too.
Enormous.
You know,
yeah.
And then, you know, you can go down the list. There was Forever was a huge, huge hit.
It's their biggest hit since Beth, actually.
Really?
Yep, that's their second to Beth.
Second to Beth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's crazy. Think about that.
Written by Michael Bolton. Co-written, I think.
Co-written by Michael Bolton. And, I mean, what other way, like, what other better way to tell somebody, to tell someone, like, I love you, than a power ballad co-written by Paul Stanley and Michael Bolton? Come on.
It is. That's, yeah, for sure. I mean, there's just so many, even within that 13 years, there's so many sides to it because you had them going for the power ballad market, right? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, we'll get all the girls and the girlfriends and the boyfriends and the couples, we'll get them this way. But then within those 13 years, they're like, oh, we gotta step it up, make it heavy again. So Revenge was within that era too. And that was their kind of return to heavy as it was marketed. Mm-hmm. And then there was also the whole, at the end of it, it's like, oh my God, like Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam, we got to do this grunge thing. So Carnival of Souls and stuff. So it's a very interesting era of 13 years.
Yeah, I got a feeling to that. The years were longer in the 80s and the 70s.
I know, right?
Than they are now.
Yeah, you know what? 13 years, like 13 years ago, that Umiya show.
Yeah. That was, I mean, we haven't
14
changed.
14 years ago.
We haven't changed a bit.
Yeah.
You're still here in your helicopter shirt, and I'm wearing this dancing stuff, and it's just the same, you know? There's a lot of parallels between Kiss and the Beatles, right?
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, Kiss is basically the Beatles meets McDonald's.
Perfect description. Yeah, exactly. I would agree.
A very Americanized version of the Beatles. Yeah. It's looking at the cover of Destroyer and you're 7 years old and it says, buy me, you know, and you do. So I would say like the first Kiss album from 1974, Kiss, it's their Meet the Beatles, basically. And I could see Destroyer being their Sgt. Pepper, in a way.
Yep. No, it is. Yeah, I could see that.
And what else?
There's Yellow Submarine and what is it? Is it Help? Like movies paralleling with
records.
Kiss Meets the Phantom.
Yeah.
Then, you know.
Yeah. So that would be. I could see Dynasty being there, Abbey Road or Let It Be, you know, with like a darker, more serious sort of touch on things, you know. And Hot in the Shade, it's the White Album. I know I said that in a Kiss group on Facebook and shit.
I can't even move my lips.
and because
did the internet blow up?
That group blew up and I was like, oh my God, what did I do? Because like the White Album is basically a bunch of
please tell me what you please explain.
The Beatles, the White Album. It's a bunch of songs that were written. Everybody were like in their own corners working with separate songwriters and other musicians and sort of brought demos and all that. And it's way too long. It's like two discs and all that. And it could have been a very good like
one album.
But they wanted to include everything they had just to see. And a lot of like different styles on that album songwriting wise. Just to see what, you know, throw it to the wall and see what sticks, you know? And Hot in the Shade was done with the same sort of attitude. Like, everybody, we just brought in... A lot of those songs are just demos with drum machines still. And
it's probably why I don't like the sound, you know, of the album.
I
can't really listen to it because I don't like the sound.
And it's being like, it's on one disc. I think it's 18 or 17 songs squeezed into one, like, cheap, thin 80s vinyl, you know? Hot in the Shade is a long, long, long play. So I always thought, like, yeah, that's the White Album of Kiss. And I know people got mad at me in that Kiss group when I said that, but if I had said that in a Beatles group, things would have been way worse for me.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that. But Hot in the Shade for me is like one of the, I just can't, it's almost, it's unlistenable to me.
I respect that. And I
And I love that era. Yeah. Like, I love that hard rock era that they were trying to capture.
Yeah.
But I just never believed it when Paul and Gene tried it.
And they did that Rise Tooth video with, you know, wearing makeup again. And they looked so uncomfortable. It's just like, they did not look... They looked way younger in 96 when they put the makeup back on for some, I don't know, plastic surgery perhaps, I don't know, but...
I thought it was a tease to them putting it back on even back then.
I think they were testing the waters,
yeah,
but it didn't really resonate with the mainstream.
Because it was before the internet. You know, if we mm-hmm. had the internet, I think, and if they read it, they would have just gone, okay, we should put it back on. Because I think everybody would have just gone. But when they finally put it on, I think they did it at the right time. They waited long enough.
Oh, man, yeah. It was perfect. They let it ripen. And you know how everything, popular culture goes in circles. Everything old gets new again after like 20 years. Yeah. And in the 90s, the 70s became cool again with a lot of like the grunge bands.
That 70s show.
Yeah, it was stuff like that, you know, when that stuff came back. And all of a sudden, a lot of those popular bands are name-dropping Kiss as their mm-hmm. main influence.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, what happens? Yeah, Revenge, fantastic record, but it was just a bit too late. It was released in 91, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
If Revenge was out in 89 instead, then things might have looked very differently if Unholy had become their Enter Sandman song. Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, you know, I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
Something could have happened there.
Yeah.
But it was a bit too little too late, you know, even though I really like that album. And it's a solid lineup with Eric and Bruce.
Yeah.
And they looked cool.
They did.
Yeah.
I thought Paul looked really good for a front man, you know, like 20 plus years in by this point, and he was looking really good.
Yeah, and Gene had that goatee with...
Yeah, he's looking tough, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, that's what you should have done for Lick It Up, man, you know, like, come on.
I think they did the right thing for Lick It Up, because, you know, hindsight, of course, you would change a few things here and there.
Yeah.
But for what they did and what they had, what they knew... I thought Lick It Up was so solid, and they were already back then working with separate writers as well, you know?
Yeah.
But unlike the Beatles, partitioning off in four different groups, you only had really the Paul camp and the Gene camp.
Yeah.
They'd throw Eric a bone every now and then, mm-hmm. you know?
Eric Carr, it's a touchy subject to talk about, you know, because of his death and the way he was so unhappy with his situation in Kiss, and that they never really he was very unhappy with being in Kiss for the last few years of his career, and then he passed away, and was no sort of coming to an end of that, you know. And I that's like, for a lot of Kiss fans, I know that's an open wound still, you know.
But to defend Paul and Gene, I mean, you only just go through life as you know it. I mean, if they knew that he would pass away earlier, of course, they would have probably been more open to more of his ideas and made him feel more comfortable in the band. But you can't hold it against Gene and Paul for just, you know, bands are the way they are.
Yeah, I would never hold,
you know.
No, that's not what I mean. I just know that... in hindsight, you know, things could have been a bit different. And Eric Carr is one of those, like, I never met him. I never saw him live. But the impression you got was that he was really, like, nice, down to earth. And he knew how lucky he was being Kiss.
Yeah, you know? I from what I've read and what I've seen, yes, I have that same impression as well. But from... You know, looking at it from Gene and Paul's perspective, I can see how they would think, like, well, you're not an original member.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't start this thing with us. You know, you're a monster drummer, and that's all you are to us. You know, I could see that. But yeah, it's a tough situation walking into an already established institution.
Yeah, definitely.
Not just a band. So I could see how they're more protective of, you know, what they, you know, do. But it would have been amazing. And I think if Eric had kept going, like if he had lived, I have a feeling they would have brought him back in with the makeup. He could have, you know, maybe even made a record with him, Creatures of the Night 2. You know, he could have kept going, you know. The possibilities are endless.
Definitely, and especially now when rock music and bands have been around for so long, there's no rules anymore for how you want to set up, what you want to... I mean, Black Sabbath, they're sort of doing their farewell tour now, but I could see them, you know, bringing Tony Martin back into the band and doing like a Headless Cross thing, you know. And I wouldn't be surprised if they did that, and I would be stoked.
and same goes for Kiss, you know. On the Kiss boat, I was talking to Frank from Hatebreed, who's also a huge Kiss fan. He said on the Kiss cruise, they're gonna focus on Creatures of the Night for this cruise, but what's to stop them from focusing in on, you know, let's say Animalize in the future, and just bring in Bruce and play all the songs. And let's be honest, it would be a hell of a lot easier to not have to put on the makeup for them and the costumes. I know they're used to it, but they just walk up and just play. You know, I think, you know, like the possibilities are endless, and there's no rules anymore. They don't have to adhere to the makeup.
Definitely, you know? And I think one of the coolest things in history is their 95 Unplugged show at MTV. Just showing that, because they were so used to playing acoustic, they wrote a lot of songs on acoustic guitars and singing harmonies. They had been doing that for 20 years at that point. And they were so good. And that was when Paul was still a killer singer at that point. And they look good, and the selection of songs was, they didn't pick just the hits, they picked the songs that would sound good unplugged. Just so smart. And then, of course, Ace and Peter entering the gig, like at the end of it, which is, it's so strange when I think about it, because I remember seeing Kiss MTV Unplugged in I think MTV aired it in December 95 and I watched it, and I saw, because that was sort of like pre-internet was around, but information was not, it was still in the era of like Alta Vista and stuff like that, you know. and you didn't know that, you only knew that Gene and Ace and they had been fighting in magazines and, like, you know, taking punches at each other and all that. And they seemed so on such bad terms. And all of a sudden, they just woke up and they played together. And all those, you know, those old posters you had, and the videotapes that you had seen of them from the 70s and all that. And it felt so long ago, and all of a sudden that was real again. And it's so mind-blowing to think about that today, that between you and I sitting here today on the 26th of May in 2016 in Umeå, it's been longer now between us being here and Kiss reuniting at MTV Unplugged in 95 than it was between the release of Destroyer and MTV Unplugged. It's crazy.
Whoa, say it again. So
it's a shorter time between the release of Destroyer to MTV Unplugged than it is from MTV Unplugged to you and I sitting here talking about Kiss.
Has it?
Yeah.
21 years ago.
Yeah.
You're right.
It's insane.
Yeah, you're right.
It puts perspective on things, right? Like from 76 to 95.
Oh, that's
95 to 2016.
That's crazy when I think about it like that.
Yeah.
What's the starting point again? From MTV is the end point. What's a Destroyer?
Yeah.
From Destroyer to MTV Unplugged is shorter than when MTV to now.
Yeah.
Holy fuck.
I mean, think about that.
And yeah, time is fucking flying.
That's what I'm saying. The years were longer in the 80s.
Because we weren't on the internet.
Probably, yeah.
Sucking up like an hour goes by now when you're on the computer and you're answering four emails.
Yep.
And then you look on your phone, you're like, three texts. There's an hour.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's, you know, less options too, I think. You know, you just had TV, and if you're lucky, you might have had a video game system or your friends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now everyone has.
And that was also a part of why KISS was so important to me. I grew up in a village like 2.5 hours north of Umeå. Around 600 people lived there. And very like industrial, Christian, hockey, backwards. And when you're pre-information age growing up being into music over there, it's I mean, if you say that you want to do music, you could as well say, yeah, I want to be an astronaut. You know, it makes just as much sense. And being into a band like KISS when you're an outsider and you're 10, it creates, with that all that image and the music and the, looking at record covers and all that, it helps to create a bigger inner world for you when you're outer world is sort of limited. And I think that's something that a lot of people yours and my age can relate to with them. They growing up with them and being a fan of that band when you were a kid was very stimulating for your imagination and for your perception of music.
That's a good point. And I think it won over a lot more people than they're accredited for in terms of, you know, making music their livelihood and life, or at least making music a priority.
Uh-huh. Definitely. And I'm sure that, I mean, I drifted on to punk in the early 90s, and reshaped me again. Like, that was a very important part of my, that's what I'm doing now. But it had to start somewhere, and if you're 7 or 8 years old, it's easier to get into KISS than, let's say, the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to say anything bad about the Sex Pistols saying that, but KISS are not being credited enough for that, you know, for putting some imagination back into rock and roll.
Yeah.
In a time where it wasn't really happening. So, I think that's something that we can both agree on. And that's why they're in the back of our heads, because they have that larger than life thing that, like road dogs like you and I, we will never really get there. But
yes, it's true. Yeah, the options are just endless now for everybody, not just kids, but for all of us.
Yeah.
It's the way that KISS still managed to stay in the news and stay in the headlines is because they got us.
They got
all those years ago.
They got us all this.
So, you know, when Gene says something in the news, I will always like pay attention to it, even though I disagree with him 99% of the time.
Yeah, I mean, when he's not breathing fire, spitting blood, or singing God of Thunder, he should shut up.
Yeah. He's spitting blood and breathing fire. Yes. Yeah. When he's not doing that, he's actually doing that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true.
But yeah, I mean, that's another podcast unto itself, like just what Gene Simmons says.
Oh, my God.
But recently, it was actually very interesting.
Oh,
if
yeah.
You heard about all that, and you obviously did.
Yes, I did. And it puzzles me, but I'm not, and also how Gene is the face of the band nowadays, but Paul runs the show.
Yeah.
It's so obvious that Paul is pulling the strings and he calls the shots.
You know, it's interesting, the tweets that Paul did, that one tweet that Paul did, actually did a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And but the one tweet that made the news,
yeah,
just confirmed what I think a lot of like real Kiss fans knew already.
Yeah.
I think in the beginning, I could be wrong, but in other years, it's kind of been like Paul's follow suit with Gene. But these days, and I don't know how long these days have been. Yeah, like you said, Paul's the boss. I think it came like that transitionary period when Gene was trying to score that movie career.
Mm-hmm.
Paul just took the reins and then...
Yeah, it's strange because like during the entire 80s, Paul wrote all the good songs. And even on like smashes, trashes and hits, he's front on the cover. And the other guys are like in the back. In the videos for that record, he's not even playing guitar. He's just dancing and singing like front man. And then Revenge and all that, you know, they shift the gears a bit. You had the reunion. It's interesting, they did that grunge record too, the Carnival of Souls record, where that was Gene's idea. He was like, yeah, we have to, you don't understand music these days, Paul. This is what the kids want to hear.
But then they shelved it.
Yeah, they read it. And it's just, then Gene took charge, and Paul didn't like that. So like, Paul, you can either like, okay, you can complain about Gene not being there, but when he's there, if you don't like what he's doing, like, how do you want it? Like, if he's going to contribute, he's going to do different stuff than you. And then you had the entire reunion thing, Farewell Tour, and then Rock the Nation, and then everything sort of blurs together for me after 2004, after that A Live Symphony thing. I'm not really like the tours sort of are sort of never ending and never beginning. I don't get it.
I think for me it's after the reunion. I just can't keep up, and I'm unless there's something that kind of pops itself up in the news, I'll pay attention. But like you said, Gene's always playing catch up.
Oh yeah.
His solo album, Gene's last solo album compared to Paul's solo album, you could really tell that Paul is happy. Paul knows who he is. He's not trying to chase anything.
No.
And you either love it or you don't.
Yeah.
Whereas Gene's always going like, hey, I'm...
Everything for everybody.
I'm like you kids, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, Prodigy's really, you know, really popular. Hey.
I'm going to do Firestarter.
Let's do Firestarter. That's great. I, you know, breathe fire and... Yeah. Prodigy, all the kids love it.
Yeah.
And that just shows that he's but you'll always lose in that game.
Yeah.
You know, so Paul, you know, you might not like everything, like the Paul stuff, and I understand, but at least he's being himself.
He's writing songs.
Yeah.
He's doing what he likes to doing. And yeah, Carnival of Souls was the perfect example of like, yeah, here's a band that no one cares about writing music for a demographic of fans that are not into Kiss. And the people who are into Kiss, they are not into this kind of music.
Yeah.
But that's also what makes them so fantastic.
Fun as hell. I love it, man. Like
because I'd rather have that than, let's say, I mean, when Sonic Boom came out and everybody was just like, yeah, Paul is producing... They're just the band, no outside writers, and it's going to look a bit like, you know, Rock and Roll Over and all that. And you listen to it, and it's like, yeah, they went into the lab, and they tried to Frankenstein Rock and Roll Over. But just like in the movie Frankenstein, you know, the monster escapes and throws a kid in the lake. It did not turn out the way it was intended to do. So yeah,
I almost wish that they would let like an old school Kiss fan who's you know a producer in their own right or whatever.
Nicke Andersson.
That's a great idea.
He should produce the next Kiss.
That's a great idea. But you know they'll never let go of the reins completely, even if they bring him in. But that would be an I would love to hear that Kiss record.
Yeah, because, I mean, Imperial State Electric, they sound more like Kiss than Kiss do many times.
Yeah.
It's almost like you see them live and oh, they're going to do the encore. Is the drummer going to come and sing on a chair and sing Beth? What's going to happen here? Yeah.
That's a great idea. Holy smokes. I mean, if Paul's listening, let this guy, his name's Nicky Anderson. Nicky. He used to be in the Helicopters. Just Paul, if you're listening, like just give him a call.
Yeah, give him a call. Yeah, he's a good guy.
He's
a very good guy.
Yeah, I think they opened. Helicopters opened for Kiss on one of those.
97, I was there.
Scandinavian tours. Yeah.
They blew them off stage.
I mean, that would be an amazing.
I know that Imperial State Electric also opened
for
Kiss.
Oh, they did? Yes. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so they have sort of. They've been in the same room. I don't know how much they have interacted as
right,
people.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know if I ever met Gene or Paul or what. Like, I'm not sure that I would be able to. Like, what do you say?
That they haven't heard a million times. And,
yeah.
When I met Gene.
You met Gene?
Yeah. In Philadelphia in 2005.
No way, man.
And he was really cool to us. Really cool. And we were at WYSP in Philadelphia. The radio station was putting on an event called Babe Fest. And it was kind of like a wet t-shirt contest. And we were one of the bands.
Jones playing Babe Fest.
We were one of the bands playing. And Gene Simmons was the host of the event. And so we were at the radio station plugging the evening and, you know, on the air. And then, you know, they went to a song and then they got the call. Gene's on his way up. And I was like, holy fuck, this is going to be it, man. I'm going to meet Gene Simmons. And he walked in and he was really nice. He shook all our hands. He knew that everybody had stopped talking and they were just watching him. This is off the air. And he was totally nice. And for the rest of the day, he had the biggest room backstage, obviously.
Yeah.
But he was the only one. He was an entourage of one. He came by himself. There was no other person with him.
Wow.
So he was just sitting in the room, almost, I would say, bored. Because I walked by his room and I kind of looked and I couldn't see him. I was peeking into the room because it was so big. Then he was at the other end in a chair and he just goes, come. So I walked in. And we took some photos. And, I walked in and I grabbed my records and markers and then the other guys came in and we took some photos and we talked and he was really nice. You know, he is Gene Simmons and he saw us play, you know, and whatever, but I mean, whatever, but it was a great moment. He didn't ruin it for me basically, you know, and that's the thing. I've heard varying stories about Gene and Paul, especially Gene, that it could go left or right, but thank God it went okay.
I think in person, without a microphone or a camera on him, he's a sweetheart. That's the impression I get of Gene. Like, if he wants to be.
If he wants to be, yeah.
Because
there was no girls with us, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't trying to impress any girls or become like. There, it wasn't a macho.
Show off.
Like, it wasn't like chest pounding situation. Had there been, I think, a girl there or a couple girls or something, I think then he would just like, I have a feeling he would like change, you know, his disposition. Those guys are that way. But yeah, he was totally cool with us. And he knew that we were big fans.
Okay.
You know, so he's not going to tear our world down.
No.
You know, and there was nothing else for him to do. That was another thing. There's no other distractions. We were it. It's either us. Or he just goes back to, like, reading this flyer of what happened last week. He was that bored.
Okay.
You know, this is before iPhones or anything.
Yeah, so. Definitely. Yeah.
But it was good. I've never met Paul. I'd love to meet Paul.
Yeah. I want to meet all of them. I think Gene, I would know what to say. Paul, I'm not really sure. He seems to be very self-conscious. And very sort of protective of his private life and all that. So and he doesn't seem to be like that into talking about Kiss. I get, that's the feeling I get from, because he's
in it. He is Kiss.
He is Kiss.
About it.
But he needs the star and the makeup and all that. And he's more, I don't know, he sort of separates himself in a way that I find sort of hard to pin down. Like, who are you really? I read his biography, which was the most anticipated one of all the Kiss biographies. And oh my, like, that was a tough life from the start. And he's dealt with so much self-doubt and insecurities and being bullied as a kid and always being like, you know, picked upon and all that. And there's a lot of sensitivity with Paul that I register now that I didn't register from before. It's funny though, because like I always looked upon Ace and Peter as the rock and rollers, but when you think of it, it's actually Paul and Gene, because they were focused on music. They wanted to do music. They weren't into, in you know, wild partying, whatever, and being like all self-destructive and all that. They wanted to play in a band. That's rock and rollers for me.
When I look at Ace and Peter, I think the same way. I think of Ace as, oh, he wants to drive fast cars and Peter wants to shoot off guns.
Yeah.
When I think of Paul, I think of, yeah, this guy wants to strap on a guitar and sing.
Yeah. And even, I mean, reading Peter's book, he's very bitter. Then you got Ace, he's like, it's kind of like a dry cracker that he throws you because you want to know so much more, but he doesn't remember it. And it's like, okay, so Paul and Gene dragged you around for so many years doing what you did, and they really protected the image that you were in the band.
Yeah.
When you weren't really, because, I mean, Peter wasn't there for Dynasty and he didn't play in Unmasked. Ace, Creatures of the Night, he didn't play a note on that record. He's still on the cover, you know, just because they needed to protect the image, but also they were under contract obligations that Kiss were Gene, Paul, and Ace at that point. And when that got obvious that Ace wasn't in the band, the contract was void. And yeah, they had to renegotiate with their record label, and they lost tons of money from. And that's always like, Gene and Paul, you know, they can slam Ace all they want in media and say like, yeah, he fucked up and he left the band and he's not fit to wear that makeup anymore and blah blah. But in reality, they're just pissed that he left right in the moment when they needed him the most. Like, that's, you know, they lost a big Phonogram contract because Ace wasn't in the band at that point. So that's the only thing it's about.
Well, it seems to have been patched up.
Oh yeah, the new Ace Frehley Origins, the Fire and Water.
Fire and Water, the free cover.
Oh yeah, did you see the interview they made?
Yeah, the 6-minute interview. Yeah, I thought that was nice. You know?
I loved it. Yeah. You know, just.
Paul's he's always on.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, it's like he's got kind of a screw up his back. You know, they just turned him on.
Turn him on.
And but still, just seeing them without makeup, just hanging out, having a good time, means more to me than, I mean, rumors right now are that Ace is going to return when this tour is over, which I can't really see happening, you know? It's just too weird. I'd rather see them just being friends and making a song. Like,
I think that's what's really going to happen.
Yeah.
They're older now. Why? Just, you guys have your camp, he has his.
Yeah.
I think the Ace, especially with the cover, mm-hmm. I mean, with the Paul appearance, yeah, gave Ace a much-needed shot in the arm for this album, mm-hmm, of his, and I think it'll do really well because of it. So I think it's all water under the bridge now.
Yeah.
I think what it could do is set off even more. of these kinds of things. Maybe next Gene will do it, or Ace will play a solo on the neck, you know, something like that.
And I rather have that than another shot at the original lineup.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that to diss anyone. It's just that train has left. That's just not in the stars anymore.
It's not going to lure anyone to check Kiss out. You know, the people who are going to check them out are going to check them out regardless if Ace is in the band or not.
Uh-huh. And also, I think Kiss are so happy about where they are as a band right now.
Yeah.
Paul is the boss. Gene is the spokesperson. Eric and Tommy are hired guns that are doing their job, and they know they're doing a job, and they have no problems with playing this part. And they are corporate Kiss. They're doing Kiss Cruise. And last night I went to see Kiss Rocks Vegas at the movie theaters.
That's
what they're doing. They're headlining festivals, and they're doing very they're corporate Kiss. That's where they want to be. And they're not interested in, they want to play it safe. That's what they want to do, and everybody agrees. And that's, I don't see a need for them to change at this point.